So today's lecture is by Rabbi David Wolpe. I really don't need to do an introduction. I'm sure everyone knows him. I have a nice long biography which I can tell you, but I'm not going to do that. I just want to give you my own little anecdote. This morning, I woke up and my dog had eaten the corner of your book.
I hear that so often.
My dog chews a lot of things, but usually doesn't chew books. And so I regard this as his very personal affection for this book. Now, I have to admit that I've read a lot of books on David over my time. I've actually written a book related to David as well. So it's always interesting to see another book on David. The interest in it as you capture is an abiding interest. But I have to admit that of all the books I've read on David, I can't actually say that I've enjoyed reading a book more than this book. And the book is both erudite. I mean, if you know the literature the way I know it, you can see on the pages all the different sources and learning, things that I haven't read. I really appreciated the way you integrated scholarly literature, like Baruch Halpern's very detailed scholarly work on David, as well as the vast array of Jewish literature on it, and the way you were able to put it all together in such a readable form. So I really enjoyed this book. If I were going to recommend a book on David, this actually would be the first book of all the books I've read that I would recommend on David. So we are really privileged today to have Rabbi Wolpe here to speak about David's divided heart.
Thank you. Thank you. It's delightful for me to be here in front of a group that I know sort of spans the range of people who are very familiar with the story and people who, like most of us, come to David fairly new. That is, we have some sense of David and Goliath. We have some sense of David maybe in Bathsheba. But David's most detailed of any story in the Hebrew Bible, he is largely unfamiliar. And I want to say something first about the fact that David is, or I am David's, someone is someone's namesake, that we share the name David, which obviously is not an uncommon name. But when I first started talking about this, I would tell the joke about the rabbi and the doctor, that the doctor comes up to the rabbi and says, "You know, Rabbi, when I have patients, sometimes if they're poor, I treat them for nothing." And the rabbi nods. He goes, "I do that too." The doctor says, "Well, when I write them prescriptions, and if the pharmacy doesn't cover it all, I subvent the prescription so that my indigent patients don't have to pay." And the rabbi goes, "I do that too." Now the doctor, in mounting frustration, says, "Well, sometimes I do surgeries, and if I know that the hospital charges above what the insurance will pay, I will literally pay myself for the surgery so that they can get the care they need." And the rabbi says, "I do that too." The doctor now, it's just sputtering with frustration. He says, "Look, Rabbi, with all due respect, you don't have patients, you don't write prescriptions, and you certainly don't do surgery." The rabbi goes, "Oh, no, I didn't mean that. I meant I say nice things about myself too." So I say this because when I first turned the early drafts of the manuscript of David over to a couple of friends of mine, every now and then, of course, when I would say something about David, they would write in the margin, "Is this about you? Or is this..." So I want to disclaim all that follows. It has nothing to do with me and everything to do with the original David. And it was my interest in David was a psychological study. That is, I can say something about the historicity of the narrative, and I'll be happy to, especially if asked about it. But I really was interested in this character because what struck me about it, and the question to which I will return at the end, is why would you pick him as the forerunner of the Messiah? There are lots of better candidates, at least superficially, than David, who is a morally ambiguous character at best. So I wanted restrict my comments to just three areas, and then we can have a discussion. The first is David's introduction in youth. The other is David and women, and the third is David's legacy. When David is first introduced, what is most striking about it is God says to Samuel, you know, Saul has failed in the kingship for a variety of reasons. I want you to go off to the house of Jesse the Bethlehemite, and there you'll find the new king. So Samuel dutifully goes off to the house of Jesse, and he asks him to present his sons, and out comes Eliab, who's a tall, handsome, strapping figure of a man. And Samuel gets up to anoint him, and God says, don't. He says, because you should pay no attention to his appearance or his stature, I've rejected him. Because I don't see people the way you do. Ki adam yirel einayim. People see what's visible. V'adonai yirel elevav. But God sees into the heart. So Samuel goes, you know, next please. And he brings out all seven sons, which is the perfect number. Right? In Irish literature, the seventh son of a seventh son is going to be the Redeemer. It's in mythology. It's in the Bible. And he says, are you sure you don't have any more kids? And his father says, oh, there's a little one out back tending the sheep. And he comes in. He says, he was young and ruddy-cheeked and handsome. And he says, rise and anoint David. He's the one. What struck me about that story, even though in a later version of the story, David is the seventh son, but I'm going to assume that the Samuel is original and correct, is David is an afterthought. That's what an eighth son is. He's an afterthought. His mother isn't mentioned anywhere in the story. His father forgets to introduce him to the company. I mean, literally, it's like the president comes to your house and you introduce three out of your four kids, and the other one was up in his bedroom, you just forgot. That's what it's like. It has that kind of force. And you realize that David's tremendous ambition, which I will speak about in a minute, might be driven in part by the fact that he's the kid in the back of the class that you never call on because you don't realize that there's a spirit and a mind back there until one day he says something and you're astonished. The second introduction to David is that David, which I'm going to table for a moment, is David and going to the house of Saul. But then you have David and Goliath. And the story of David and Goliath, which I'm not going to spend as much time on as one could, is the story, first of all, of David's own resolution. Remember, he comes there because his father says, your brothers are out there fighting the Philistines, go bring them something to eat. So he goes, and in the immemorial manner of older brothers, his older brother Eliab says, what are you doing here? You know, go away, you punk. I'm paraphrasing, but that's essentially the sense of it. And David, of course, says, you know, in the manner of younger brothers, forever, I'm not doing anything wrong. Why are you criticizing me? But before that, David speaks his first words in the Tanakh. And it's characteristic that your first words in the Tanakh will set a seal on your character. That is, who you are. So for Abraham, the first thing he says is, Hineni, here I am. Which is Abraham, I mean, the knight of faith, he's present, that's who he is. Saul is saying, you know, here's this Goliath who has challenged all of Israel, because what Goliath said is, let's have a one-on-one combat instead of troops. Saul says, you know, I need to find someone who will be a champion against him. He can't find anyone. David comes along, and the first thing he says is, what will be given to the guy who defeats Goliath? Then he says, because he's insulted the God of Israel and so on and so forth, but it has to be to the sort of practiced biblical ear. You say, look, the first thing the guy says is, what do I get out of this? And also, you notice that David volunteers to defeat Goliath without God's prompting. God never says, you must do this. It is entirely David's own initiative. So first he expresses his ambition and even his graspingness, and then he is ambitious and, of course, supremely self-confident. Now, why is David so self-confident? I mean, I'm gonna elide the conventional because God is with him answers for the moment. He's so self-confident because the truth is, even though we think of Goliath as having the advantage, he doesn't. David has a long-range weapon. And if you can wield it effectively, It's like that scene in Indiana Jones, where one guy has a whip and one guy has a gun. Yeah, the whip guy looks very formidable, but if you can pull out a slingshot and hit him from 30 yards away and he can't reach you with his javelin, then in fact, David has the advantage. What is striking about that, though, is that no one else thought of it, that no one else did it, and that David constantly enlarges possibilities, thinks of things that people around him could have thought of but didn't. And by the way, as you may know, they've done studies now with Bedouin shepherds who spend all day out. You know, when you're all alone with sheep for hours and hours and hours, the only means of recreation is your slingshot. So they spend hours, like, knocking over things with, and they can get very good at it, and the velocity can get very frightening, and it's not at all implausible that you could kill someone with it, although probably the account is a little ambiguous. David actually kills Goliath with Goliath's own sword. He knocks him out, and then he cuts his head off with the sword. So you might be inclined to believe, and you would be very justified in believing, that David is essentially a Machiavellian man after the main chance. And in fact, again and again, throughout the story, one of the remarkable features of the David story is it's repeatedly one of those gestalt tests where it depends how you look at the picture. You can either see the chalice or the two faces, depending on how you see it. It happens 5, 6 times, I don't know, 7 times, that David's enemies are killed, right? Like Ish-bosheth, who's David's rival for the kingship. A couple people kill Ish-bosheth in his bed, come to David and say, "We have killed Ish-bosheth for you." David says, "How dare you raise your hand against Saul's son?" He kills the people who killed Ish-bosheth. And you can see that one of two ways. Either here is David, this righteous man, who, even though they killed his enemies, which you would think he would celebrate for, he doesn't celebrate. In fact, he punishes the people who did it. Or you can say, here is David, who has not only succeeded in arranging the assassination of his enemy, but has killed the only two people who could say that he told them to kill his enemy. And I can't tell you which one is right. But the same thing is true here. That is, with Goliath, your immediate reaction is, unless you've been, you know, inured to believe that David is this, you know, naive shepherd boy who happens to be good with a slingshot, your reaction is, this is a very calculating man. But then the third introduction is he goes to Saul's house. And Saul, look, it's thousands of years since Saul lived. We only know him through the Bible, and I'm not a psychologist. And I always kept in mind, as I was writing this years ago, I heard a biographer say, and I wish I knew who said this, because it is a brilliant line, but I've lost the author, but I remember the message, said, the next time you read a biography, ask yourself how well your best friend would describe your love life. And when you realize how poorly even your best friend knows the intimate secrets of your soul, realize that someone who never met the guy, who only reads his letters, who never talked to him, in other words, have a healthy dose of skepticism. So I don't know about Saul. It's thousands of years ago. I'm not a psychologist, but he was manic depressive. just a stab in the dark. Or at least the narrative portrays him as a manic depressive. And David is summoned by Saul's assistants to help him in his dark moods and coax him out of that darkness. Now, this is an aspect of David that you would not have imagined before this, which is he has this genuine, and you'll see it again, deep emotional empathy and capacity for empathy and a sort of poetic soul. Whether he wrote the Psalms or didn't write the Psalms is a question that's worth debating, but he clearly has this sort of poetic soul that enables him to summon even Saul, who has, I mean, not only darknesses, but lots of reasons to be suspicious of David, to summon him to feel better. So those are the three introductions of David. Then the last piece of this, before I get to David's David and women and David and love, which is a huge and fascinating subject, although I promise it'll be a short bit on it. Here's the transition. David comes into Saul's house. Now, there's no way, even though he's already been anointed by Samuel and the chronology is all messed up and it's a series of snapshots or vignettes and it's not necessarily sequential, there's no way David can be king. He can't be. Not only because Saul is already king, but because Saul has a firstborn son, Jonathan, who's going to be king after Saul. And the only way David could be king is if he, A, kills Jonathan, which he cannot do because you kill the son of the king and nobody is going to make you king in Israel. Or if he persuades Jonathan somehow to give up his own privileges in favor of David. Okay, those are the only two ways. So David comes into the house of Saul. And in short order, what do you find? Saul, it says, loves him. Michal, Saul's daughter, loves him. The first woman, and maybe the only in the Bible who is said to love a man, is Michal loving David. Depends how you read Song of Songs. Jonathan loves David. The people love David, and God loves David. David is by far the most, I mean, the name David means beloved, by far the most loved character in the Bible. No one else comes close. And so you ask yourself again, it's another, not a Rorschach, but another Gestalt test. Is it that David walked in here and said, huh, I can charm the pants off these people, and before you know it, they'll all want me to be king? Or is it that he was genuinely so charismatic and lovable that they fell in love with him? And my own very amateur diagnosis is, first of all, I don't believe that there is an unmixed motive in the world. That is, anybody who thinks someone is completely Machiavellian is probably misreading them, and anybody who thinks that someone is completely altruistic is certainly misreading them. But also, I feel as though, and again, I'm assuming that the narrative is reporting this accurately, I feel as though those who knew David, to assume their stupidity is to be condescending towards them. That is to say, Michal and Saul and John, they were all duped. Is to assume they were first dupable, but also to assume that we know better than they did whether David was lovable or not. So what interests me about this, though, is that although David is loved, David is never said to love. And the question is, can David love? In the famous eulogy for Jonathan, he says, "Your love was sweeter to me than the love of women," but he doesn't say anything about his love for Jonathan. I will tell you the one fascinating thing. This is my only actual contribution to David's scholarship, as opposed to gathering David's scholarship and saying it. And it's not really a contribution to David's scholarship, but it's as close as I came. The Septuagint, which you know is the early Greek translation of the Torah, and sometimes of the Tanakh, and sometimes it includes phrases that we miss, like it supplies the dialogue of Adam and Eve, for example, of Cain and Abel, and sometimes it is missing pieces. It's slight differences. The Septuagint says later on, when I'll come to the Amnon story, that David didn't punish his firstborn son Amnon because he loved him. But it doesn't say that in our version in Shmuel. So the ambiguity of whether David could love goes all the way down to the textual level, which is an amazing thing. It's like we even have a text that says he could love, but it's not in our text. So anyway, more about that in a minute. David, eventually what happens, I'm obviously skipping a lot, but there's a lot to talk about. So David eventually becomes king. Saul and Jonathan die in battle. And then the opening of the chapter, I think it's chapter 8 in 2 Samuel, is it was spring, the time when kings go to war. Kings go to war in spring because, one, the ground is hard, right? And two, there's fruit on the trees. So the troops have something to eat, and their horses won't get stuck in the mud. I was just reading about the trenches of World War I, and you can just imagine what it is. I mean, there were literally soldiers in the trenches of World War I who got stuck in mud up to their knees and had to be abandoned by their comrades because they couldn't get them out. They just couldn't get them out. That's why you go to war in spring and not at Flanders. But what is David doing? David's wandering on the roof of the palace. And when it says kings go to war, and then it says David's wandering around the palace, there is an implicit criticism of why isn't David going to war? Because his troops are at war. Israel is at war. It's just David who's not at war. And you do get this sense of David has accomplished everything, and now it's time for the fall, right? It's just, it's almost like it follows Greek tragedy. And he spots Bathsheba and sees her bathing naked. And again, here's your gestalt test. Was Bathsheba doing that deliberately or not? Was she trying to seduce the king? I have no idea. All I can say is that whether she was or not, one, she's introduced as the husband of someone and the daughter of someone, as if to say, this woman is really taken. Right? There's no way that David could assume, well, you know, she's untethered. And second, there's a clear power imbalance here. Whether she was trying to seduce the king or not, it's the king who gets to say, you come to my palace, and she doesn't get to say no. So David summons her, she sleeps with him, and then she says, I'm pregnant. Her only bit of dialogue until the end of the story, by the way, when she has lots more dialogue, but I'm pregnant. So David summons her husband home, Uriah. Now, Uriah is a Hittite. He's not an Israelite, which means that he's one of those tribes that Israel incorporates that fights with Israel, but you would, the reason that it's significant narratively is you're going to expect a lower level of morality from a Hittite than you would from an Israelite. After all, he's one of those, you know, pagan peoples. He comes home, and David says to him, you know, how are the troops doing? Uriah gives his report, and he says, now go home and sleep with your wife. And Uriah says, how could I do that? How could I do that to you? How could I go sleep with my wife? After all, my master's troops are out in the field, and they're fighting, and he lucky David, he sleeps with the noble guy's wife. So David then decides to get him drunk. And he gets him drunk, and he still won't sleep with his wife. So he commits the most cynical act of brutality in all of the Tanakh. He writes a letter and says, basically, put this guy in the front and make sure he dies. He gives it to Yoav. Sorry, I turned my own phone off. He gives it to Yoav, who is his general. And he gives it then to Uriah to carry that note with the king's seal, his own suicide note that he is carrying to the front. One of the reasons why I would argue for the historicity of the story is not only because it says such bad things about David, which would be almost unthinkable to make up about someone you want to be a hero, but other times it defends David against other charges, and it requires a very labyrinthine imagination to think that someone would write a book and make charges and deny them about someone who never existed. So Uriah goes to the front, and sure enough, Yoav puts him in the fighting, and he gets killed. Now, the other thing that this is something I have said this, and I haven't found it in another David book. This is my only other contribution to David scholarship, although one of my teachers thought that it was incorrect. Nonetheless, I said, if David saw Bathsheba bathing on the roof, she couldn't live that far away. And therefore, when he says to Uriah, go sleep with your wife, he's not saying go sleep with your wife in Ventura, you know? He's saying, you know, go sleep with your wife right over there. She's got to be close, right? Okay, good.
Absolutely.
There you go. We're done here. At this point, as you may know, the prophet Nathan comes to David and says, there was a rich man and a poor man. He tells a parable that doesn't fit exactly, but it fits closely enough. There's a rich man and a poor man. The rich man had many flocks and herds and sheep and cattle and so on and so forth. The poor man had one lamb that he cherished and cared for. The rich man had a visitor, and he went to the poor man, took the lamb, slaughtered it, and served it to his guests. What should be done with such a man? And David says, such a man deserves to die. And Nathan then, in perhaps the most dramatic moment in the entire story, says, you are the man. And I want to point out two things about this famous moment. One is that David earns immortality by what he doesn't do. What he doesn't do is say, off with his head. Because he's an ancient king. You know, Saul killed all these priests not that long before. And I remember in the course of researching the book, I came across the story that Herodotus tells, where the son of Cyrus, Cambyses, who was a Persian king 500 years after David, wanted to marry his sister. And he asked all the wise men to find a rule that said he could marry a sister, and they came back and said, look, we've scoured the law books, we can't find any rule that says you can marry your sister, but we found a rule that said the king can do whatever he wants. So that was the prevailing ethos in the ancient world and far on even the modern world. And so the idea that David doesn't kill him, that David repents and cries, really does set a tone for a different Israel. The child dies. The second child, of course, of Bathsheba and David is Solomon, who will become king. Without going into the question of the Solomon's lineage and so on, which some scholars doubt, but I don't see any reason to. Anyway, the third part that I wanted to talk about, I'm not going to talk so much about the revolt against Absalom, except to say something about the, if you have not read the story of David, one of the reasons why, I will just drop this in here, and you can ask me about it or not, but one of the reasons why Warner Brothers optioned the book for a movie, which they did, I'm loath to say it, but they did. Okay. Look, you got it out of me. So, is because the story is brutal, but also extraordinarily realistic. It's not a mythic story. It's not a Noah story. It's really not. And one of the ways that you illustrate that is the first half of the book is David running from Saul. The second half is David running from his son Absalom, who rebels against him. And the way the rebellion starts could almost be taken out of the newspaper. That is, Absalom has a sister named Tamar, and he has a half-brother named Amnon. Amnon conceives this desire for Tamar, and he manages, with a little bit of David's consent, whether David was aware of it or not, to get himself alone with Tamar, and he begins to rape her, and she starts to scream, don't do this, and says, my father will give, David will give me to you, just don't do it this way. Whether David would do that or not, we don't know. That could have just been a plea to get him off her. But he doesn't listen, and he rapes her, and then it says, and then Amnon hated her with a hatred as great as the lust he felt before. Now, every single time you read rape is a story of power, not only of lust, I mean, the psychological insight and the realism of the David story are unremitting. This is not a story of splitting seas and worldwide floods. This is really a story of human beings in which God plays a relatively small part. There are no supernatural miracles in the whole book if you don't include Samuel being raised from the dead, which is not clear whether it really happened or not, but if it did, that's the one miracle. It's a big one, I grant you, but it's the only one. Just that small little, so a guy came back from the dead. He wasn't that dead. It was like the Princess Bride. He's only mostly dead. So in any case, that leads to Absalom and David having an estrangement. Absalom ends up killing Amnon for what he did. And then there's a rebellion. And then comes one more moment of realism, and then I'll wrap it up. David says to his troops, whatever you do, don't kill Absalom. Like, put down the rebellion, but don't kill my son Absalom. And of course, Yoav, who's the general, he doesn't live by those kinds of rules, right? He sees Absalom hanging in a tree, and he kills him right away, unapologetically, without any worry. And then David is devastated. You know, the famous scene where he's walking on the balcony of his house and he says, Absalom, Absalom, like Faulkner's novel, if only it had been me, they should have killed me instead of you, Absalom, Absalom. And here is this fantastic scene. It's really a fantastic scene where Yoav comes to him and says, cut it out. What's the matter with you? Don't you know what all of your troops are seeing now? They're seeing the man whose life they tried to defend, right, you, mourning for the person who was trying to kill you and giving absolutely no attention to the people who risked their lives to save you. So if you want to have an army tomorrow, you better stop this today. And David does. Now that kind of scene, that isn't the kind of scene that you normally associate with biblical stories. And it gives the story a power and a realism. If I could know more about any character in the book, it would be Yoav. Yoav is a fascinating character. But And I wanted to say one thing also about David that makes him different from every other man in the Bible, I think. It's fair to say, probably. And almost every other man today, which is he listens to women. I mean, really listens. Sorry if I'm besmirching all men today. But when I say he listens to women, I don't mean that every now and then a woman says something and David doesn't interrupt them, although that would be enough. But or say, I know the directions. But David changes his behavior repeatedly based on what women tell him. The longest speech by a woman in Tanakh is when Abigail talked. By the way, Abigail, good trivia question. The only woman in the whole Torah who is called beautiful, who is called intelligent before she's called beautiful. Abigail. And she gives this long speech to David, and he changes what he's going to do because of what she says. There's a woman called the wise woman of Tekoa, who's basically a woman off the street, who comes and tells him a long tale, and he listens to the whole thing. So David, every time you think you've got him pinned down as a no-goodnik, David shows an emotional complexity and depth and resourcefulness and awareness that don't square with this brutal king who goes around killing people. Then you come to the end of his life, and I just want to say two things about that, about the Messiah and then how he dies. The question that I began the book with was why David gets to be the Messiah. And the usual answers, I used the usual answer sort of to include in my answer, which was in some ways a larger framework answer. And that is, if you think of the Messiah as the sum of human qualities and character, which in the Jewish tradition is what the Messiah is, not supernatural. I mean, remember that Rabbi Akiva thought Bar Kokhba was the Messiah, had he won the battle. Then you have to think about David. David is everything. Not only does he deal with the Philistine threat and found the city of Jerusalem as a capital in between the north and the south and unify the country, which stays unified for a very brief time, but there's no hint of idolatry in David, which is almost unique among the kings of Israel. And also, here's a guy who's a poet and a warrior and a lover and a sibling and a child and a parent and a disciple and a musician. And it's like every human quality that you could have. I can't think of a character, certainly not in the Bible, but maybe not in all of literature, who has the broad range of humanity that David has, light and dark. Good at, he's a savior and he's a murderer. Both. And when God says David is a man after my own heart, which is what God says in the book of Shmuel, so you think, Oseh shalom uvorei ra, that's what Isaiah says about God. God makes peace and creates evil. That is, in the Jewish tradition, God created everything. So who is most representative of God, a human being that is everything, that isn't in one box or another box? And that's part of what I think maybe the reason David gets to be the theologically, not historically, but theologically the progenitor of the Messiah is because he's the most comprehensively human of us all. And there's a little, not a hint of that, but at least a suggestion towards it. I'll close with this in the description of David's end. The first chapter of Kings, which is the end of David's story, begins, Melech David Zaken Baba Yamin. King David was old, advanced in years. One chapter later, it says, Vayikrevu Yemei David Lamut. David was dying. And the rabbis noticed the difference. When he's old, he's King David. But when he's dying, he's just David. And they say, when you die, when you face your own mortality, you don't face it as a king, as a professor, as a doctor. You just face it as David. So here you have an illustration of this most complicated human being face to face with who he is in the moments before he dies. And so I felt really enormously grateful to be able to write about him. And the way that I know that it was the right choice is because when new stuff comes out about David now, I still am as eager to read it as if I were still writing the book. Because I didn't, once you get involved in his character, any possible new facet of it that's revealed to you shows you, just as Bill said in his opening, shows you a new side of this most complex, multifaceted, and variegated, bright and dark and endlessly interesting and important King of Israel. Thanks. Okay, so please, questions, comments, whatever you like. Yes, please.
You Professor. Said at the beginning David never loved anyone. People love him.
Well, I said it doesn't say that he loved anyone.
It doesn't say.
Right.
Because definitely right. He loved Absalom.
It seems that
Although
way.
Although you have stopped him, but right. And when his son, the baby son, was
yes.
very sick, he mourned.
I agree.
Before. I'm definitely. And unfortunately, also what you said about he was very sensitive to women,
yes.
except unfortunately to his own wife.
Yeah, well. Michal. Yes, yes and no. Okay, so good. Two obviously critical points. I want to say this about, the first is David mourned the baby who died and Avshalom. And that, I'm going to say I agree with you that he loved Avshalom, but I'm going to make the counter argument why you could say he didn't, if you wanted to make the counter argument. The counter argument is, first of all, you can be attached narcissistically to your kids without really loving them. Mm-hmm. And second, he was partly guilty, both for the death of the first child and for the death of Avshalom. So I don't know how much of that weeping was for his own fault before God. Second, yes, he was sensitive to women. He was also brutal to them. One does not preclude the other in this case, and certainly to Michal, who, according to one of my readers, what is the most tragic character in the story. I always think Saul, but you could definitely make a case for Michal or for Tamar. You have a lot of choices. Yonatan, I would say, I don't know if he's the most tragic. Yonatan might be the purest in some way. He's the best character. He dies in battle, but a lot of people die in battle. But before that, he got
battle
to be...
Battle of love.
Yeah, but he got to be the king's kid before he died. so, I don't know, maybe. By the way, the whole David-Jonathan thing I'm happy to talk about, too. But David, the marriage to Michal saves David's life, by the way. But the marriage to Michal seems like a marriage where there's never any indication that David sees her as anything other than instrumental. Even when he brings her back, where there's this, again, it's the subtle touches that are so memorable in this story. What happens is, David, after he becomes king, he's long since run away from Saul. He hasn't seen Michal in years. She's remarried to a guy named Paltiel, but David wants her back. Now, why does he want her back? It's not because he says, oh my God, I can't live without Michal, but remember, she's Saul's daughter, and being married to the king's daughter is a helpful chizuk, a helpful strengthening of his position. So, she's taken from Paltiel, who's her husband, and he follows her weeping. And I think that we're supposed to understand the contrast between David, who's not weeping, but gets her, and Paltiel, who's one of those people, and there are many, who got caught up in the coils of history among people who are much more powerful than he and has no choice. So, yeah, I would say that that is certainly true. Yeah.
Yeah, so I just two things. This is really wonderful. I would love to hear your take on the relationship between
sure.
Jonathan and David, and your opinion as to whether or not it was homoerotic,
right.
as some have said. And the other thing is, you mentioned early on that David is empathetic, but he's you and I had a conversation. Before yeah. you started writing about David as the narcissist.
Yes.
Is he a narcissist or is he empathetic, and can you be both? Okay.
Well, again, I'm not a psychiatrist. Here's what I would say. And I think that we toss the term narcissist around too easily. I will tell you what I observe in his character, and I'm going to avoid the label. Is he very confident and determined and ambitious, and does he take care of himself even when it's at the expense of many, many other people? Yes. Does he have the capacity to listen and understand to what other people want and respond to them in a compassionate way? Yes. So I don't know what that goes under, but I would say The problem with calling him anything is that then you rule out of court its opposite. And what I was consistently impressed with, the more I read and studied David, is that no single or even congeries of labels begins to capture him. The same thing, by the way, is true about the relationship with Jonathan. Remember that in the ancient world, as we know from Boswell's work and others, there wasn't this categorization of homosexual, heterosexual. So the question is not, was David gay? That's a question that's misconceived. The question is, was David's relationship with Jonathan, exactly as you said, Carol, was that a homoerotic relationship? So here is the answer. You can read it either way. That's the truth. And I will give you the sort of best arguments of both sides. So the side that says no, their argument is the prohibition was so strong, as evidenced by Leviticus, that if the Bible thought it was being assumed that this was homoerotic, wouldn't have portrayed it that way. And in the ancient world and in the medieval world, just read Shakespeare, male friendships are often described in deeply romantic ways without any sexual implication being taken. Okay? So that's the anti-argument. The pro-argument is that some of the language is very sexual. Not only your love was sweeter to me than the love of women, but what Saul says to Jonathan about his relationship to David, it's a shame to your mother's nakedness. It's kind of, you know, there's a sexual implication there. But that might just mean who birthed you. So it's not certain. The other part of this is that David and Jonathan served together in war, which is a very bonding experience for men. And even though you would say that if that was going to be taken erotically, it wouldn't have been put in there, there are a lot of things David did that were wrong that were put in there because apparently they were known. So I think you're free to read it either way. And I don't think any argument is dispositive. I don't think any argument clinches your point. But whichever you like is okay with me. Seriously. Yeah.
Listen, I just want to ask. I want to defend Saul, too.
Mm.
You said you are not
a psychiatrist.
He needs it.
Right.
And you said he was a manic depressive.
Right.
Was he naturally manic depressive, or he was made or forced to become by Samuel, by David, yeah, by all the circumstances of life?
Yes.
For fear I have a lot of sympathy for him.
So when Steve Zipperstein first asked me, that's how I came to write this book. This is how the book started. Steve Zipperstein came to me, who was a professor here for many years, now is up at Stanford, and said, you know, we're doing this Yale University Press. He's one of the general editors. We'd like to ask you to write one in the series. He said, you know, we thought you'd want to, you can write about it, any Jewish character you want. We thought you'd want a biblical character. Moses is taken. That's exactly how he said it. So I said, that's fine, because I would go for David. But if I hadn't done David and there was enough material, I think I would want to do Saul. Because I really do see Saul as a tremendous, maybe the most tragic character in the Tanakh. And it's tragic because Saul has the terrible fate of being chosen for a job that he is not equal to. And everything depends on him, and he's just not good enough. He's just not. And so he has some successes, which are also, it's also bad. I mean, if he failed at the very beginning, that would have been better. It's like, good. I remember with Joseph Frank writing about Dostoevsky, said the great tragedy of his life was the first time he gambled, he won. Because then he became a lifelong gambler, right? If he had lost the first time, maybe he wouldn't have. But so then Saul, and the example that I give in the book is, what's his name? Tells this story about Verrocchio and Leonardo, the Vasari, the guy who wrote about all the Renaissance painters. He says, there's one painting from his studio where you see an angel that is done clearly in a different hand and is infinitely better than everything else in the painting. He says, and that moment is a tragic moment. Because that's the moment the master looks at the student and says, oh my God, I mean, it's the, you know, it's the Salieri Mozart moment. I can do a lot, I can't do this. So there's a moment in Samuel where the women of Israel are saying, Saul has killed thousands, which is good, and David has killed tens of thousands. And when you're confronted with a David, I mean, it's over. There's nothing. So not only is Saul inadequate to the job, but then along comes someone who is like supernaturally talented. And so Saul's descent to darkness, yes, it could have been situational. But remember, when Samuel first comes to find him, he's already hiding. When Samuel first comes to find the new king, he's hiding. So Saul was not by disposition. And what Saul was, by the way, was tall. And there are three characters whose stature, whose height is commented on in the book of Samuel. Saul, Eliab, David's oldest brother, who's not king. Remember, God says, pay no attention to his appearance, his stature. And Goliath. So, and I think that in a way, that's supposed to be an analogy for Israel. Don't neglect the little, because being big doesn't make you good. It doesn't make you successful.
Yeah. Can you speak a little more about this notion of being a man after God's own heart? You touched on it, but it's such a powerful statement, only said of him.
Yes. So I think what it means, my and this is clearly from the tradition, is that David has very uneasy and unequal relationships in lots of ways, but he and God are constantly close. It really is. I mean, it's in good times, in bad, David never turns away from God, never neglects God. He may betray God's will, but he never betrays God, I think is the best way to put it. And so I think what God has found here is someone who, from the very beginning, whose long-term interests are aligned with his own, and who feels this very intimate relationship with him. I think the reason that the Psalms are ascribed to David in part is because they're personal prayers, and you get a sense of David as having a personal relationship with God in a way that you don't with other characters in the Bible. So, you were going to say?
Yeah, I mean, I have lots of questions, but one of the things that strikes me when I'm working on David that any researcher, writer has to deal with, and I noticed in your book how much literature you read, is it seems to be a modern tendency to take a very jaded interpretation of
yes.
David. I mean, I think it started with Halpern's David's Secret Demons. You certainly see it in Jacob Wright's, Mackenzie's book, Joel Bodden's new book.
That's right, I read it.
And it, of course, goes in the exact opposite trend that you saw with the Book of Chronicles, but also the Septuagint and Jewish interpretation through the ages. And I wonder if you want to comment.
I do. I have a theory about it. I have a theory about why people see David darkly today. And although you did not ask, this also dovetails with why I think people want to make a movie. It does. I know. Okay, so it's self-serving, but I still think that it does. I'm going to try to convince you that it's not entirely self-serving. It's just like David is self-serving, like 80%. So I think a lot of it has to do with our attitude towards heroes and our attitude towards rulership in general. That is, trust in government and government figures is at an all-time low. And I think David, in the time of Roosevelt, was a hero. David, in the 21st century, I don't even want to say in the time of Obama, in the time of Bush, Obama, Clinton, all the leaders is a Machiavellian no-goodnik. And that's, by the way, that's why I think the reason that someone asked me, David is such a perfect character for a movie. And there's another studio also that started that is involved in making a David movie. And someone said, why? And someone else wants to do some kind of miniseries. They said, why now? So the reason is because we're used to anti-heroes now. You know, after, like Sopranos, you can have someone who is a hero, but he's still all the things that David is. Mm-hmm. But I think that it used to be that David had to be the David of Chronicles. I mean, look, the rabbis even, and also in our tradition, by the way, the rabbis, even they go so far, and I don't want to say all the rabbis, because some of the rabbis condemn him for Bathsheba, but some of the rabbis exonerate him for Bathsheba. Now, you wonder, how do they do that? I will tell you. It's very clever. It's cleverness in service of a completely indefensible point, but it's very clever. So they say, look, first of all, Bathsheba wasn't married. You think she was married. But when the Israelites went off to war, they would give their wives a conditional get. That is a writ of divorce in case they didn't come home. Because they didn't want what if their bodies were lost? They didn't want their wives to be chained to them. So they were divorced until they came back home. And then their coming back home nullified the get and they would be married again. So first of all, she wasn't married. So it wasn't adultery. So take off your high hat, you know. And second, Uriah deserved to die. Now, you may not have heard this, but I said it. I wondered whether I would get to this or not. He says to David, how can I go and sleep with my wife when my master's troops are out in the field? Now, whose troops are out in the field and who's he calling my master?
David.
Yoav. That's what the rabbis say. He's referring to Yoav as his master, and he's defying a direct order from the king of Israel, who tells him, go home and sleep with your wife. You know what you call that? Treason. He's committing treason, he's not married, and you want to blame David. Honestly. I don't know what's the matter with you people. So you understand, now I want to say why they do that, but the reason you understand why it doesn't work ultimately is, if that's true, then what's Nathan talking about? I mean, the story itself contradicts it so clearly. But the reason the rabbis do this is that we only have half of the argument. What I mean by that is, there were people who read the Bible who were not Jews, who were pagans, who were other religious traditions, who would attack Israel on the basis of the immorality of their own heroes. And the rabbis would defend them. They'd defend Abraham taking Isaac. They would defend, you know, Jacob. They would defend Joseph. They would defend all the heroes who have morally ambiguous actions in the Tanakh. And all we have left are not the attacks, just the defenses. So the defenses seem ridiculous and overdone and unnecessary, but that's only because we're not being attacked. But for them, where it was really life and death, the polemics, it makes sense, and David is the most attackable of all. I haven't even told you the worst thing that David does, because I don't want to. But I will tell you in some ways, and this tells you, by the way, this is a Steven Pinker moment. You know how Pinker wrote that book, Better Angels of Our Nature? And Ian Morris also, War, What Is It Good For? Both books, which are both really unbelievably gripping and interesting books, thick as they are. Pinker argues that violence has steadily declined, even with World War I and World War II, steadily declined from Neanderthal times through ancient times, through medieval times, through modern times. You can follow the graph very clearly. He says, like, your chances of getting killed in a town in England in the Middle Ages were infinitely higher than the worst neighborhood of the worst ghetto of the worst city in the United States. So, and also, by the way, look at how horrified the whole world is by beheadings. Several hundred years ago, we would have said, so someone beheaded someone. That happened all the time. Our outrage is a measure of our moral progress.
Even in England.
So, yes.
In the Royal House.
That's right. Yes. I mean, and France during the time of the Revolution, right, which isn't so long ago. The guillotine, don't forget. Anyway, so what here's David's worst deed, and it's reported very evenly as though it's just, this is what he did, and that's a measure of how different biblical morality is for ours. David runs off to the Philistines because Saul's trying to kill him in Israel. And he has to prove to Agag, the king of the Philistines, that he's a loyal subject, or he'll kill him there. David has a band of bandits, basically, around him. So he says to the king of the Philistines, I'm going to... Not Achish, not Agag, I'm sorry. I'm going to Israel. I'm going to kill people in Israel, raid their towns, and bring you back part of the spoils. That's how he's proving to Achish that he's loyal. What he's really doing is going to non-Philistine towns in Philistine territory, raiding them and bringing back the spoils. But you realize that if anybody tells Achish that, David will be killed. So in order to make sure that no one tells him, he goes to those towns, raids them, and kills the men, women, and children. Everybody in the town. Now, the Tanakh reports this as though this is what he does. And there's no condemnation of it whatsoever. But it just tells you how different the world was from what it is. And it's a stunning, you know, it's a stunning difference. So, yes. I couldn't hear.
The book of
yes. Well, about whether David wrote it?
Yes.
So whether David wrote the Psalms is an interesting question. Some of them he clearly didn't write because they refer to events that happened after he died. Some of them are possible that he wrote, and it's because it's based not only on the fact that it says Mizmor le David, which could mean a psalm of David, but can also just mean a psalm about David, to David. It has lots of other possible meanings. But also because there's a psalm included in the book of Shmuel, although it doesn't seem to correspond. The problem with the psalms is, if they really were written by David about his life, he was very opaque. That is, they don't fit very well. On the other hand, they're psalms of great devotion in which the person presents himself as a king, so it's possible. We don't know whether they were written by professional poets for recitation in the temple or whether some of them were actually from the hand of David. There's no way of tracing it back far enough to know, but it's certainly possible, if not certain. That's about as well as that's about the best we can do. Yeah.
In studying the life of David, one thing that's been super interesting for me is to look at the period after Goliath, when Saul is chasing him, the development that he goes through in those years of his life. Can you talk about how those years affected David?
So David, the wilderness years. The thing about his running away is, first of all, he gathers around him a band of people. With the death of Nabal, he gathers some wealth. And he has to decide what attitude to take towards the king of Israel, who is pursuing him and wants to kill him, when, according to the story, he himself has already been ordained. And twice he has the opportunity to kill Saul and doesn't. And I think that in that time, what you get in David's story is, first of all, he develops himself as a leader, but also as somebody who wants to establish the sanctity of the monarchy if he can. Because remember, it's very bad to become king by assassinating your predecessor, because it sets a precedent. But also you see, I think, unless you're very cynical, you see his genuine attachment to Saul, who's kind of his surrogate father, and how much he doesn't want for Saul to kill him, and how much he wishes to believe, which he does for a while, but then gives up on the belief, that Saul doesn't want to kill him back. And so in some ways, I suppose, that's how David develops the skills that eventually allow him to be a king. But also, I think that it's true that we have to keep in mind that David's skills as a king always have to be moderated by the reality that his son Avshalom got enough people around him to be able to launch an almost successful revolt. So there must have been a lot of people who didn't like David too, and that probably is a function, among other things, of taxes, which all kings have to raise, and disaffected populations, which all kings and presidents and leaders always have. Anyway, so last question.
What do you make of the mysterious story towards the very end of the David narrative of this sin of counting the people and the
good question to end on.
70,000 people?
Okay, so the sin of the census. David gets punished for the census, and he has a choice. He can suffer himself, or he can let the people suffer, so he chooses to let the people suffer in good kingly fashion. The question is, why is a census a sin? And here, I'm going to give you a superstitious reason and a practical reason. The practical reason that the census is a sin is that a census is almost always taken for tax reasons. So that's a sin. The superstitious reason is, don't forget, we're told throughout the Torah that you'll never be able to count the Israelites. God promises they will be beyond counting. And to count people is, by itself, a creepy thing to do in mythology and the Jewish tradition and so on, because you're normally counting them for some nefarious reason. So when David decides to take a census, which is probably for taxes, God comes to him and offers him three punishments, one of which is a plague, and that's what David chooses. But I think that the likeliest scenario there, and here I'm taking off my taking off one hat and putting on another, is that it's not that David's counting caused the plague, it's that the plague had to be explained. That is, there were plagues in the ancient world. So if you have a plague while David is king, and it's around the time that he does something, and he's always going to do something, then you can ascribe the plague to what he did. Because one of the things that we have discovered throughout history is that people demand to be able to explain things. And if they can't explain it one way, they'll find a more superstitious way of explaining it. But the one thing they won't do is live without some sort of explanation that they can hang their hat on. So that would, my guess is, there probably was a plague, and they had to figure out why, and David's counting was as good a story to weave it around as any. You know that in the Book of Chronicles, which cleans up the David story, takes out all the bad stuff, it's basically, the way I refer to it in the book is Chronicles is Samuel made boring. but it says that Satan incited him, that Satan incited him to count. So you pay your money, you take your choice. But I think that that's it's probably a function of the necessity of explanation as opposed to the prohibition by itself. Because even in the Torah, we just read in the Torah about how you had to bring a half shekel to the sanctuary. So there are other ways of counting. And the nice thing is the half shekel in the sanctuary is called a kofer nafsho, a redemption for your soul, which years ago, Milton Steinberg gave a beautiful sermon about that, in which he said, this just shows you everyone owes a debt to life, which I think is a lovely idea and a good one to end on. Thanks.
Thank you.